Okay, well, welcome back to our final installment of our Introduction to American Law, Part 9. Today we're going to be looking at criminal procedure. And if you're following along in our text, and the text, of course, is Law 101 by Feinman, you'll find this material that we're covering today, pages 301 to 345, where we're going to discuss criminal procedure. Which the author defines pretty broadly as the whole process of investigating, adjudicating, and punishing criminal behavior. So in our last chapter, we learned substantively what is the criminal behavior. But as you recall from one of our first sessions, that the state or any level of government can't take away your life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Certainly in the case of the criminal law, they might take away your property in the form of a fine. They might take away your liberty in the form of imprisonment, and they might even take away your life. So they can't do all those things without some process. It has to be a due process. And as the author points out, nearly half of the Bill of Rights talks about the subject of criminal procedure, because obviously it's a pretty important part of our rights that the framers of the Bill of Rights decided to devote half of that material to the subject of criminal procedure. So a lot of what we're going to be talking about today is a version of constitutional law, because much of criminal procedure, not all of it, but much of it is constitutionalized. The government is restrained in what they can do when it comes to the criminal procedure because of the Constitution. In other words, in that process of investigating, adjudicating, and punishing crimes. What are the goals of the criminal procedure law? Despite the odd title of the chapter, I take a look at that title again. I don't know exactly why freeing the guilty. That's not really the purpose of criminal procedure. But instead, the purpose of criminal procedure is, first of all, to punish the guilty, but also at the same time to protect the innocent. And that's a big subject covered by the Bill of Rights. And of course, the 14th Amendment incorporates most of those rights into state prosecutions as well, because the original Fifth Amendment said that the state can't take away your life, liberty, or the federal government can't take away your life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Well, the 14th Amendment makes clear that it's a federal case if the state tries to do that, because it says, the 14th Amendment says, none of the states can take away your life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And what exactly does that phrase mean, due process of law? Well, over the years, the court has recognized that many of those protections in the original Bill of Rights, that is due process of law. So there has to be a jury trial. For example, the states can't dispense with juries, because that's pretty ingrained in our system that one of the parts of due process of law is a jury trial. Not everything, though, in the original Bill of Rights is incorporated. So there's the doctrine of selective incorporation. Some of the rights enumerated in the Bill of Rights the states are charged with also following those, but not all of them, for example. So, for example, the Bill of Rights says that if you have a case involving $10 or more in a civil case, you're entitled to a jury trial in all cases, in all civil cases of $10 or more. If a state decided to change its statutes to say that you're not entitled to a jury trial unless the amount in controversy is more than $20, well, that would probably be okay, because that's not one of the fundamental rights that's been selectively incorporated into the 14th Amendment. Although if a state came along and said, well, you know, we're going to, you don't have a Fifth Amendment right of against self-incrimination in this state. So you're required to testify against yourself. Well, I think the Supreme Court would say, no, that's one of the fundamental rights. So when we say that no state can take away your life, liberty, or property without due process of law, one of the things that they were talking about when they said due process of law is the fact that you can't be compelled to testify against yourself. The fact that it's in the Fifth Amendment is pretty strong evidence that that it's a fundamental right. In fact, because it is a fundamental right, that's incorporated into the 14th Amendment under that doctrine of selective incorporation. And, you know, if you follow the news at all or follow history, you'll see that, you know, those two sometimes conflicting priorities, the priority of punishing the guilty. That's a legitimate interest of the criminal procedure, and so is protecting the innocent. And you'll see over the years, you know, there is a pendulum that swings between those. You know, I think everybody would agree those are worthy goals that, you know, you if we really wanted to crack down on crime, you know, I suppose we could, you know, throw a few innocent people in jail just to show that we mean business. But I think even the most zealous law and order people would probably agree that that's a bad idea. On the other hand, I think even the most zealous civil libertarian would say, well, you know, we want our system to be as perfect as possible. But on the other hand, you can't let all of the prisoners go free just because, you know, there's a possibility that one of them is innocent in there. So it's a pendulum that swings between those two conflicting priorities, namely a safe society and the punishment of criminals versus our individual rights. The courts are always trying to strike a balance before those two sometimes conflicting priorities. Another priority or a goal of the criminal justice system is truth seeking. We want the system to figure out the truth. Did you rob the 7-Eleven? Well, we're going to have a trial to figure that out. And either you did or you didn't. You know, there's some objective truth in there. And the one of the goals of the system is to seek the truth. On the other hand, a possibly conflicting priority is the goal of efficiency. You need the system to work efficiently. But you don't want it to work too efficiently. Because as the author points out, if you're a police officer, you see a lot of crime. And unfortunately, you do. Unlike most of us, I don't witness crime on a daily basis, but police officers do indeed witness crime on a daily basis. They see a lot of crime, maybe there's a tendency to see crime where there's not crime as a result of that. Just like, you know, if you go into any public building, you'll see door stops. To prop the door open. And if you ask the firefighter, they would want to just remove those things entirely because they see fires. They realize that if there's a door stop in a door, well, then when the people leave, they might not close the door behind them and the fire might spread. So if you're a firefighter and you see fire every day, you're going to be attuned to that. And you're going to say, we should make these things illegal. But on the other hand, if you're a civilian, you look at those and say, well, wait a minute. Sometimes we need to prop the door open just to get some air into the room or whatever. I'll try my best to make sure the door closes if there's a fire. On all those occasions when there's no fire, Can't have that. So if you're a police officer, so just let, you know, so that firefighter is going to see a fire hazard everywhere. And, you know, you might have to, look at it and say, well, yeah, it's a theoretical hazard, especially if you see fires every day, but, we can't let that fear, take too much precedence. Well, similarly, if you're a police officer, you're going to see crime in a lot of places, well, most people are not criminals. So we don't want the system to be too efficient because, like I say, if you're a police officer, understandably, you're going to see a lot of crime, maybe in places where there is no crime. So you need to seek the truth. You have to be efficient, but not too efficient. Another possibly conflicting priority is we have to be concerned about the dignity and the status of the individual. So, most people are not criminals. We have to recognize that. And we recognize that mostly in our system with the presumption of innocence. And that's a very important goal of our system, or a very important mechanism that we have in our system, the presumption of innocence. Because if you're standing trial for a criminal offense, you have the presumption of innocence. Even though, as a factual matter, and this is actually a good thing as a factual matter, that most people who go on trial are guilty. They're probably guilty. They probably did whatever they are charged with. So if you see in the paper that I am on trial for robbing a 7-Eleven, well, then I probably did rob a 7-Eleven. Because otherwise I wouldn't have been put in that position. And as a factual matter, that's the case. And that's a good thing, too, because it would just be an intolerable situation if we were trying innocent people on a regular basis. If most of the people who were being tried for a criminal offense really were innocent, because that would be kind of intolerable because some of them would get convicted. And we don't want to, so we want to, as the system goes through the investigation process and the charging process, well, we want the innocent people to be, kind of winnowed out at that process so that yes, as a factual matter, if you're standing trial for a criminal offense, you're probably guilty as a factual matter. But on the other hand, the legal presumption is just the opposite. The legal presumption is that you are innocent. And even though you are probably guilty, well, we're not going to tell the jury that, you have to be proven. Somebody, namely the state, has to prove your guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And we'll talk later on what exactly that means. Well, we won't talk too much about it because there's really no way of defining it too much. The other thing to keep in mind about the criminal procedure system is that a lot of it is specifically designed as a restraint on government power. Yeah, we don't want criminals running around amok, but on the other hand, we also don't want the government running around. We don't want a government that's more dangerous than the criminals. Yes, there will always be criminals. And yes, we have to figure out some way to deal with them. If you're in North Korea and you commit something that, people everywhere would recognize as a crime, well, the government of North Korea certainly has the should have the legitimate power to punish you for that criminal behavior. If you murder somebody in cold blood for no good reason in North Korea, well, what ought to happen is the North Korean government ought to throw you in prison for doing that, because you've committed something that everyone would recognize as a crime. So I guess in those situations where that happens, we can pat the North Korean government on the back and tell them that they've done a great job. But on the other hand, that's a system that's run amok. I guess I would really rather live in a country run by criminals rather than a country run by the North Korean government. So criminal procedure really has to serve as a restraint on government power to keep us from turning into a North Korea. Even though we might have criminals too. So yeah, we have to keep the criminals in check, but we also have to keep the government in check. So those are some of the kind of overarching principles that that govern our study of criminal procedure. And again, as the author notes, it's a pretty important subject, as evidenced by the fact that over half of the Bill of Rights deals with the subject. Turning to page 306 of the text, we're just going to give the briefest of overview of the process of the criminal procedure system from start to finish. In 5 minutes, we'll take something that we'll study something that could take years to learn all the intricacies. So we're just going to start from the beginning. How does the process begin? Well, the process begins by a crime, but more specifically, it begins with a suspected crime. There might not be a real crime. There could be this whole process could take place, and there was no crime. And hopefully the system will figure that out. So there's a suspected crime, and not only is it suspected, but it's reported to the authorities. Somebody picks up the phone and calls the cops and says, somebody's been, tampering with my property or whatever. So there has to be a suspected crime reported to the police. And at that point, there's going to be some kind of investigation. The police department will somehow investigate it. They will examine the evidence, and at some point, they might talk to witnesses. But at some point, of course, they might talk to the they might have an idea who they think it is, and they will go have a talk with that suspect. And we'll talk about some of the issues that come up in regard to that a little bit later on. But in general, there's going to be this investigation. What the author talks about is, when they talk to that suspect, one issue that oftentimes comes up is the concept of a stop and frisk. We'll actually go into that a little bit more detail, but when they talk to the suspect, they might, to make sure they're safely talking to him, they might want to make sure that he doesn't have any weapons. So the investigation might include that. It might include other kinds of searches. So we'll get into a little bit more detail later. If the police think they got their person, they will arrest him, and they'll probably go through a procedure down at the jail known as booking. So it's not part of the judicial process yet, but they're just going through the police departments or the county jail's internal procedures for getting the names of everybody that's in their jail. So they have that booking process. We're going to get into the hands of the attorneys here pretty soon. But before we do, I want to stress one thing, that at every step of the process, even before the attorney gets involved, because up to now we don't have any lawyers. We just have a citizen who had something happen to them and a suspect and the police officers. But all these people at every step up to this point and continuing have a certain amount of discretion. The victim might not bother calling the cops at all because, it was just a little piece of petty vandalism. It's not a big deal. Or the police might say, well, yeah, technically this might be a crime, but we don't have enough resources to deal with it. It's just not that big a deal. Or they might not arrest the person. It's some kid who was shoplifting candy bars. So the police officer uses some discretion and just drives them home. Has a good talking to the parents, whatever, which, you know, maybe is a better effect than tossing them in jail. So there's that discretion at every step of the process, including the following ones, including once the attorney gets involved. Because when we think of discretion, when we think of prosecutorial discretion, well, we think of the prosecutor's discretion, whether or not to bring a charge. Even leading up to that stage, there's a lot of discretion. But anyway, at some point, the person gets booked into jail, and then on Monday morning, it shows up on the desk of an assistant county attorney. They have to prepare a complaint. And a complaint is the formal document saying that you committed the following offenses against the peace and dignity of the state of Minnesota. It's the formal charging document. It's the document that's given to the defendant saying, here's what you're charged with. And it's lodged with the court saying, we want to put the person in jail for this. So let's start the judicial process going. Here's our complaint against the person. In Minnesota, virtually all prosecutions are begun with a document called the complaint. Now, in other jurisdictions, that document might be called an indictment. And we'll get to that in a minute when we talk about grand juries. The reason why in Minnesota it's almost always called a complaint is because a grand jury indictment is not required in any case, with one exception. And that exception is first-degree murder. And in the somebody charged with first-degree murder, that cannot be charged with a complaint. It has to be charged by a grand jury issuing an indictment. If you hear about some heinous crime that happened over the weekend, and then on Monday morning it's in the news, and you'll hear that the defendant was charged with second-degree murder. And then, almost like clockwork, you'll see your friends comment on social media, second degree. Why didn't they charge him with first degree murder? Well, because it takes a few more days to charge him with first degree murder. Because for first degree murder, that has to be an indictment from a grand jury. To make sure they keep the person in jail until the grand jury meets, they charge him with second degree murder. But then that's soon increased to a first degree murder. And again, we'll talk about the grand jury in a minute. But in that vast majority of cases that are started with complaint, and in the federal system, it would be probably called an indictment at this point, because everything goes through a grand jury. So the grand jury basically comes a little bit sooner in the federal system. You have a complaint. Maybe within 24 or 48 hours, depending on when the person was picked up, there will be an initial appearance before some kind of judge. That judge might not be a district judge. It might be a magistrate or some lower level of judicial official. The person conducting that hearing doesn't work for the police department. They work for the judicial branch. But not a lot happens at that initial appearance. It's not the time to try to get released, because all that really happens at the initial appearance is the court will inform the defendant of their rights. The main one, they'll probably tell the person that you have a right to remain silent. So if you do not have to answer any more questions offered by the police, you do have the right to a lawyer. Do you have a lawyer yet? Can you afford a lawyer? If the answer to that question is no, I don't have one and I can't afford it, then that the process of appointing a court-appointed attorney or a public defender would begin at that point. That judicial official would set bail. Come up with an amount of money saying that, if you come up with this much money, enough to guarantee that you will indeed show up for your trial, that bail will be set. Now, traditionally, that was, the judicial official had a lot of discretion in setting that bail amount. And now that's more according to bail guidelines, I think. So there's less discretion there. But that's really all that happens in that initial appearance. So the the judge will set the bail at X thousand dollars. And then if that person or his friends or relatives cough up that amount of money, then they can be released on bail, or perhaps the person will be released without bail at that stage. But that's the initial appearance. At some point in here, the grand jury might get involved. So like I say, in the federal system, that will have already happened. Or in the state system, really only in the case of first degree murder, a grand jury, that a group of citizens who sit for a set period of time, usually 18 of them, that grand jury under the really under the absolute control of the prosecutor, will look at the basic level of evidence to see whether there is probable cause, whether it's more likely than not, whether it seems reasonable that this person should have been charged with that offense. And if so, they will issue an indictment. That will start the process going. At some point, okay, there's that initial appearance, and then in most states there will be soon thereafter, or maybe a long time thereafter, there will be some kind of a preliminary hearing. And in the preliminary hearing is kind of the first time where the judge will really have to hear any facts of the case, basically we'll have to make, like the grand jury would have made in an indictment case, a determination of yes, there is enough probable cause for this case to proceed to trial. It seems likely that they probably have the right person and there really was a crime. So that probable cause determination will take place then. Now, I believe in Minnesota that those are traditionally called the omnibus hearing, because other issues are also decided then, such as suppression motions. We'll talk about a little bit later. So other issues might be heard at that preliminary hearing, or whatever name it has. In one of these, either probably the preliminary hearing or the omnibus hearing, that will probably also include the arraignment. And an arraignment is simply the opportunity for the defendant to plead either guilty or not guilty. So the arraignment will be in there at some point, probably at that preliminary hearing. But that could conceivably be a separate proceeding, depending on the state law. But an arraignment is simply where the defendant pleads guilty or not guilty. And speaking of pleas, pretty much any point after that initial appearance, I guess, there's an opportunity for a plea bargain. The defendant's attorney talked to the prosecuting attorney, they may decide that we'll drop the other charges if you plead guilty to this offense. That's generally accepted. We'll talk about it in a little bit more detail in a minute, but that's basically governed by principles of contract law, but with some procedural safeguards we'll talk about in a minute. Finally, there will be a trial. The part you see on TV where Perry Mason is there, which runs pretty similar to a civil trial. The prosecution presents its case and has to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt, not beyond a shadow of a doubt, as you sometimes hear, it has to be beyond a reasonable doubt. And then, of course, after the trial, there's always the possibility of an appeal. for some legal issue or a collateral attack, habeas corpus, or as they're usually called these days, a 2254 or a 2255 proceeding. For 28 U.S.C. 2254, where which is basically a habeas corpus case of a federal court reviewing a state decision, or 2255, a federal court reviewing a previous federal conviction. So that's just a really brief overview of the whole process, mostly just to kind of introduce us to the terminology. And at this point, I'm going to pause briefly for our first code number for this section of the program. Remember, if you're taking this course for CLE credit, you should write down these code numbers when safe to do so. If you're, you know, in your car in heavy traffic, don't do it. But our first code number is 9-122. 9-122. 9-122 is our first code number. This program, 9-122. Okay, well, we don't remember the first part of the criminal procedure system is the police investigating things, and they have to look for the evidence. When you're looking for evidence, you have to watch out for the Fourth Amendment. You have to watch out for these search and seizure issues. They can't just break down the doors of somebody's house to just because there's evidence of criminal conduct in there. To put it more specifically, yes, they can break down the doors if there's evidence of criminal conduct in there. The Fourth Amendment limits them in that. First of all, the people shall be free of unreasonable searches and seizures. So when they search and seize things from your house, they have to do it in a reasonable fashion. It can't be unreasonable. The wording of the Fourth Amendment is kind of curious. It says there shall be no unreasonable searches and seizures, comma, nor shall warrants be issued except in specific circumstances. Nowhere does it say that the cops can't search without a warrant, but it kind of presumes that because it says warrants shall only be issued in very specific situations, namely if there's probable cause, and it also has to be done by a judge. So there are two parts of the Fourth Amendment. First of all, it simply says no search can be unreasonable, and all warrants have to be have probable cause. Now, the general interpretation of that is that, well, the general rule is that the police cannot search without a warrant. So that's kind of the default position. The default position is anytime the police do a search, well, they need a warrant. That's the thing that makes it reasonable. Now, there are, of course, many exceptions to the warrant requirement. But that's kind of the default position. If they do a search and there is no warrant, well, they have to point to the specific exception of why they did this, why the search was reasonable, even though there was not a warrant, because the kind of the default requirement is that there should be a warrant. So you can't have a search unless it's reasonable and there has to be a warrant. But the threshold issue, though, is, well, was there a search in the first place? If I walk into the police station and say, hi, I would like to confess to a crime today. Here's what I did. There's no search because the police aren't doing anything. I'm doing everything. So for that Fourth Amendment to be triggered, there has to be a search. And what is a search? Well, first of all, it has to be a physical intrusion of some kind. I have stuff in the trunk of my car, or I have stuff inside my house, or maybe I have stuff in my backyard. They have to physically intrude to come to where that stuff is to search for it. So there has to be a physical intrusion. But it has to be a physical intrusion into a place where I have an expectation of privacy. In other words, it can't be in plain view. So if I take my illegal drugs and just set them on the sidewalk in front of my house, along with a note saying that they belong to me, somebody calls the cops and they pick them up. Well, that's not a search because I didn't have any expectation of privacy. I left it out there in plain view on the public sidewalk. If I put it in my front yard right next to the public sidewalk where they could still see it, well, then I didn't really have any expectation of privacy. There was no, because I still left it in plain view. So and where do you draw the line? You know, well, what about the stuff I have in my backyard with a tall fence? But they had to climb up and peek over the fence to see the illegal stuff I had in the backyard. Well, it comes down to, did I have an expectation of privacy? And the way I like to look at these, and I don't know if I've really ever seen it articulated this way, the way I like to look at it, the Fourth Amendment is, the Fourth Amendment stresses the fact that the police do not have any special rights when it comes to gathering evidence. They have the same rights as any other member of the public would have. So if I'm walking down a public sidewalk, well, first of all, the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply to me. And I see something laying on the sidewalk. Well, I'm perfectly within my rights to be there, and I saw this illegal stuff. It was in plain view, or even I saw it in your yard, or even I saw it in your yard while I was walking up the door to ring the doorbell for some other unrelated legitimate purpose. Well, I had every right to be in that spot at that time. And I think, I like to think of it as the Fourth Amendment just makes clear that the police, when they're investigating crime, don't have any more privilege than I do as a private citizen. So in other words, if the police are doing something that a private citizen would be allowed to do, like walking up to your door and ringing the doorbell, anything they see in the process of doing that is not a search. Or if I'm walking down the street and I peer into your yard, that I have every right to do that. I probably have every right to climb up and peek over your fence. I probably have the right to look into your backyard with binoculars, because that's just a general privilege that I have to do that. So when the police do those things, it's okay. But when they try to do something saying, well, I need some special rights because I'm doing the important task of investigating crimes, well, then the answer is no, you don't have that, unless you get a warrant, or unless it's one of these specific situations where you do have more rights because you are doing the important work of investigating crime. So I think that's the best way to look at those plain view cases. You know, what is plain view? Well, plain view just says that, yeah, police officers can do everything that normal citizens can do, but they don't have any special rights unless they comply with the Fourth Amendment. So I don't know, maybe that clears it up a little bit more. Do I have an expectation of privacy against thermal imaging? Well, you know, so the cops have a thermal imaging camera, and they're outside my house, and they're seeing what's going on inside my house with their thermal imaging camera. Yes, I do have an expectation of privacy in that one of the cases said. So maybe that goes against my theory, because I guess, you know, well, or maybe not, you know, because I guess if I was standing in front of your house with a thermal imaging camera just for fun, I don't have the right to do that. On the other hand, the police do have the absolute power to look at the aerial view. So you're growing drugs in your backyard. They can't, the fence is too high for them to peek over. So they rent an airplane and fly over your house and see it there, because, yeah, they do, that's certainly a legitimate activity for them to do, because because when I'm a passenger in a Delta Airlines flight flying over your property at 30,000 feet, I have every right to be there. Well, so do the cops. That's just plain view. What about abandoned garbage? You cheated on your taxes, and then your rough drafts of all your cheating, you just throw in the trash and put it out for the garbage man to take away. The courts basically say that's in plain view because you gave it to the garbage man, so the police officers have just as much right to that as the garbage truck would, because it's basically in plain view. But if something's not in plain view, if there's a physical intrusion into a place where you have an expectation of privacy, then the search must be reasonable. Usually that means that they have to have a search warrant. So in other words, a neutral and detached judicial magistrate, a judge, has to sign off on it. And one of the cases makes clear that judge can't be, a part-time police officer or part-time attorney general or something. It has to be a neutral and detached judicial magistrate who listens to one side of the story. They're not hearing the whole side of the story, but you say, well, we think Clem is doing this illegal activity on his property because we have we got this information. And then the judge has to sign off on that and saying, yes, I think you have probable cause. I think it's more likely than not correct what you believe. So you can break down Clem's door and see what's in there. You have probable cause, and here is your warrant. So again, in general, the police need a warrant to make a physical intrusion into a place where you have an expectation of privacy. But there are many exceptions to that. And the author says the first exception is plain view. Well, that's not really an exception. That just meaning that a warrant isn't required in the first place, because, the cops are allowed to do anything that normal citizens are allowed to do. But there are exceptions. And the first one that comes up is a search incident to a lawful arrest. If they're arresting me for some other, for any reason, legitimately, they have to have probable cause for the arrest. They have to, think that I maybe committed the crime. Well, as they arrest me, they have to, they can't just let me into the jail with my pockets full of whatever I came in with. So they have to empty my pockets, and they go through everything in there. And if there happens to be evidence of a crime in there, then that's okay. As we mentioned before, usually you need probable cause to do any kind of a search. But there's an exception to that under the Terry v. Ohio case, 1968, for something called a Terry stop. So the police can't search me. They can't make a physical intrusion into my personal space. But maybe they can make a little bit of an intrusion without full-fledged probable cause. If they want to talk to me, the police think I might have been involved in a crime, so they just want to talk. They have a couple of questions for me, but they're worried about their safety. Before they talk to me, they say, before we stand here and talk to you too much, we want to make sure you don't have any guns or knives or anything in your pockets. You don't, do you? And I say, well, no, I don't have any weapons on me. But they don't believe me, and they shouldn't believe me because I'm a criminal. So the Terry v. Ohio case says that they do legitimately have the power to frisk me. So they can't dig into my pockets and see, that the evidence of my tax evasion papers or anything like that. But they can check and make sure I don't have any weapons on me by patting me down. So that's the stop and frisk, which doesn't quite rise to the level of a full-fledged search. So they don't need probable cause, but for that, they still need reasonable suspicion. And there are other exceptions too, where they exceptions to the warrant requirement. So again, the one brought up by the author is a search incident to a lawful arrest. There's an automobile exception. You know, there's, in general, the police do not need a search warrant to search somebody's car. They can do that without a warrant. But the exception, keep in mind, the exception is an exception to the warrant requirement. They still need probable cause. The search has to be reasonable. And first and foremost, reasonable means they have to have probable cause. And of course, we could spend hours talking about what probable cause means. But if the police have probable cause, they can search my car without a warrant. They can't search my house without a warrant, unless they came up with some other exception. So that's search and seizure. Now the other another right that that you have if you're ever charged with a crime, or even before you're charged with a crime, is the under the Fifth Amendment, you have the privilege against self-incrimination, or you have the right not to testify against yourself in a criminal case. So nobody can be compelled to be a witness against themselves. So in other words, they can't, I plead the Fifth, you know, we've all seen that, the police ask you, maybe you're being asked in some situation where you're normally required to answer. What were you doing last Tuesday? You know, and you're required to answer that, but what you were doing last Tuesday was committing a crime. So you can answer, I refuse to answer that because the answer might tend to incriminate me. So I'm pleading the Fifth. So that's easy. You can't be a witness against yourself. And witness, usually that's pretty easy to figure out. If the police ask you a question and they want an answer to that question, well, you never have to answer a question if you think that the answer might incriminate you. But where exactly do you draw the line? What does it mean to be a witness against yourself? So for example, the police say, we want you to stand here in this lineup. We want the victim to try to pick you out from a lineup. You're not being a witness. You're just being, a physical exhibit at that point. So that's perfectly okay. They can take your blood and extract the DNA. Now they probably need a search warrant to do that because that's a search. But that's not testimony. You can't say, I refuse to give my blood because it might incriminate me. No, the only thing that you can refuse to give because it might incriminate you is answers to questions. You can't be compelled to be a witness, but you can be compelled to give your blood. What about some cases where they really, really want your answer for some unrelated reason? You're on trial, you're going to be a witness in somebody else's criminal trial. And you say, well, I'm going to refuse to testify because I was illegally parked that day. I was guilty of the offense of illegal parking. Therefore, I refuse to answer your questions because of that. Well, they need my testimony for this trial in this other case. So what's going to happen there is the prosecutor is going to give me immunity and say, well, no, I'm forcing you to answer that question, even though you're going to incriminate yourself. But I promise that I will not use that evidence against you. As the text explains, probably we don't really have time to go into too much detail. There are two different kinds of immunity. There could be use immunity, saying I'm not going to use that information ever again. Now, if we find independent evidence that you were illegally parked that day, we might throw the book at you. That's the most common kind. There might be transactional immunity though, too, saying, okay, you just fess up. Tell us what we need for this case, and we promise we will never prosecute you for illegal parking that day. That's less common, but that might be appropriate in some cases. But again, the right against self-incrimination refers to testimony. You can't be a witness against yourself. You can't give information against yourself. Interesting. I don't think this is covered in the text, but we want to search your iPhone. Okay. We even have a warrant, and we want to see what's in your phone because there's probably some incriminating stuff in there. Tell us your password so that we can get in there. Well, that's perfectly appropriate to say, I refuse to answer that question because that might incriminate me. They can't force you to tell what the password is. On the other hand, we need you to unlock your phone with your thumbprint. If you don't do it, we'll cut off your thumb and we'll just we'll do it ourselves. That's not testimony. You're not giving any information. You're just being forced to place your thumb up against the screen of your phone. You're not saying anything. You're not incriminating yourself. So for the Fifth Amendment to apply, there has to be you have to be giving information, not some kind of physical thing or process. So yes, they can tell you to stand there next to the other people for your lineup, or they can say, put your thumb up against the screen. That is not testimony. The Fifth Amendment does not apply there. So you can't incriminate yourself. Well, if you watch television anytime after 1964, you know of the next step in self-incrimination and implicating some of these other amendments, such as your right to counsel, something. But anybody who has watched even a little bit of television after 1964 will be able to recite your Miranda rights. You have the right to remain silent. That's what the Fifth Amendment is. Remain silent. Not say anything. Keep quiet. We'll use that information against you if you do say anything. And you have the right to a lawyer, because that's a different amendment. And you have the right to have the lawyer with you before you answer any questions. So Miranda, first of all, gives those gives your rights. And one judge or one law professor, I guess it was, pointed out one time that will the Miranda case ever be overruled? And the answer is no. And the reason why, because whatever court overrules that case would be saying, well, that was the court that took away our rights. Well, I mean, you still have the rights. I mean, but the Miranda is, do you have to be advised of those rights? The police have to give you those rights before any custodial interrogation. So do the police have to read you your rights? Well, no, they never have to read you your rights. They only have to read you your rights if they're going to do an interrogation while you're in custody. So if the police come and ask you all kinds of questions, if they have an interrogation, they can do an interrogation without reading your rights. They can have you in custody without reading your rights, but they can't do both of them together. They can't have a custodial interrogation without first reading your rights. Now, the police err on the side of caution, you'll get your rights. If you get arrested, you're going to get your rights read to you 100 times. But they don't have to do that unless they have a custodial interrogation. And occasionally they won't. And then some defendant will come along and say, I got them beat. They didn't read me my rights. Well, they didn't have to read you your rights because there was no custodial interrogation. So they have to ask questions while you're in custody. And before they do that, they have to read you your rights. The other thing about that Miranda case, really the more important thing, is the fact that you can always say, I don't want to answer your question. You probably knew that. But once you say, they ask you a question, you say, I don't want to answer that question. Well, so they ask you another question. You say, I don't want to answer that question either. Yeah, they can stay there all night asking you questions, and you keep saying, I don't want to answer that question. I don't want to answer any more questions. They can keep asking questions as long as they want. But they have to stop once you say, so if you say, I don't want to answer any questions, that's tough. They can keep asking questions all they want. But if you say, I don't want to answer questions unless I talk to my lawyer first, that's the one where the court has said that you have to scrupulously stop asking any more questions whatsoever. You certainly can't ask anything with a question mark after it. So if once the defendant says, I refuse to answer that question, well, they can ask it again and again and again. But if they say conditionally, well, I don't want to answer that unless I talk to my lawyer first, then they have to scrupulously honor that, and they can't ask you any questions whatsoever. They can't ask you about the weather, because that's a custodial interrogation after you invoked your right to counsel. So that's the one thing they're not allowed to do. They're not allowed to ask you anything ending with a question mark. They can't do any more interrogation. Well, what if it doesn't end with a question mark? Because it can get information, it's probably easier to get information out of somebody by, without asking questions. I mean, if you just start blurting stuff out, that's one thing. But if you start blurting it out because they said something to encourage you to blurt it out, well, even though it didn't end with a question mark, that's probably not going to be permitted. And that, of course, brings up from 1977 the case of Brewer v. Williams, a case from Iowa, notably involving the Christian burial speech. So the person said, I don't want to talk to you about this murder that I just committed. Well, they probably didn't word it that way. But they asked about the murder, and they said, well, I really don't want to talk about it until I get an attorney. Well, they have to scrupulously stop. No more questions. So they can't say, please tell us, did you murder the person? They can't do that. And they knew that. But what they did do instead was they were sitting there in the squad car. And, so this person murdered somebody and dumped a body somewhere. And the police officers sitting there were saying, boy, it sure would be nice if that murder victim could get a Christian burial rather than just be out dumped somewhere. And that tugged on the heartstrings of this defendant. And he said, well, I'm not going to tell you anything about the crime, but, I want this victim to get a good Christian burial. So I tell you what, I'll show you where the body is. I'm not going to admit to anything, but I'm going to show you where the body is. Well, if you know where the body is, you're probably guilty. And the jury figured that out and convicted him. But the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that, because even though it did not end with a question mark, you were giving the Christian burial speech for one reason and one reason alone. And that was you wanted the defendant to come up with this information. You wanted them to, so it worked out better than a question. So no, you were not allowed to do that because they invoked their right to counsel. What happens if they break the rule? If they break any of these rules, in general, the remedy, as we see on page 319 of the text, is the exclusionary rule. If the police do things in violation of these rules, well, then the exclusionary rule kicks in, and any evidence they gain as a result of their violation is excluded from evidence. So in that case, the jury convicted after the police officers testified. Yeah, he told us that the dead body was going to be at the corner of 3rd and Main. We drove down to 3rd and Main, and sure enough, there was a dead body there. Well, that's pretty compelling evidence of guilt. So they convicted him. But the remedy in that case was that no, that evidence is excluded. You're not allowed to share that tidbit of information with the jury. That's the remedy for violating this person's rights. So the exclusionary rule. There's a good faith exception to the exclusionary rule, though. So if the precedents from the U.S. Supreme Court were maybe a little bit unclear, and you thought you had the right to give a Christian burial speech or whatever, but you were just mistaken because the court ultimately ruled against you, They didn't apply it in that case, but if you were acting in good faith, well, then the evidence will come in anyway. So there might, even though you broke the rule, if you did it in good faith, it might be okay. Okay, we talked a little bit about plea bargains earlier. And again, they're kind of governed by contract law. You know, yeah, you agreed you were going to plead guilty, and they plead they're going to ask for a lesser sentence. Deal's a deal. But there are some protections. First of all, before you enter into any kind of a plea bargain, you have the right to have a lawyer. So, you know, will a prosecuting attorney talk to an unrepresented defendant about a plea bargain? Probably not. They won't. In fact, the ethics rules say that a prosecutor can't. Interestingly, I know the Wisconsin, if any of you are in Wisconsin, there's an exception basically for, minor traffic offenses. Because they're not quite so worried about it there. But in general, to enter into a plea bargain, you really need to have an attorney. There can't be any coercion. You can't be coerced into pleading guilty to something, obviously. But on the other hand, you can be induced into pleading it. And, then it's okay. So where do you draw the line? I don't know. You can't be coerced. Maybe you can be coerced a little bit, as long as we call it being induced. It has to be voluntary, knowing, and intelligent. You have to know what's going on. So the trial court is going to have a little bit of a plea colloquy. Make sure you really know what you're getting into. You're pleading. You're going to jail at the end of the day today. It has to be voluntary, knowing, and intelligent. And there has to be a factual basis for it. You don't have the right to plead guilty for something you didn't do. So if you truly did not do it, you can't plead guilty to it. In addition to pleading guilty, you generally have to acknowledge your actual guilt. Or at the very least, under the Alford case, you have to acknowledge that, well, a jury would probably find me guilty. But there has to be a factual basis for the plea. You can't plead guilty to things that you're innocent of. At this point, we're going to give you our second code number for this portion of the program, which is 9-279 is our second code number for this part of the program. 9-279. Before we turn to the subject of juries on page 326 of the text, what jury? That's kind of the weirdest system in the world. Who do we entrust to making these decisions about who we're going to toss in jail for the rest of their life? We just pick 12 people off the street and let them decide it. So it's kind of weird, I guess. It works reasonably well. But why do we do that? Because the main reason is. Because most of the time it does work pretty well, but mostly it's to control unchecked government power. We just do not trust any one person. We don't trust some judge to decide whether or not we're going to be thrown in jail. As a check, before we take away somebody's life or their liberty or their property, it has to be convincing enough that you can just take 12 people off the street and convince them unanimously, probably. Maybe not quite unanimous, but at least almost unanimous. Or maybe not 12, maybe 6 of them. But you have to just take some of these average people off the street, and they all have to agree that, this guy needs to spend a few years of his life in jail to control unchecked government power. Jury verdicts in criminal cases, there's a finality in that because of the double jeopardy clause that the state cannot appeal. So if the jury, despite all of the compelling evidence against this person finds them innocent, finds them not guilty, the state can't appeal that. If they erroneously decide that the person is guilty, well, maybe that could be appealed. But there's finality. The state can't appeal a verdict, right or wrong. Therefore, there is something called jury nullification. In practice, you don't really see it very often because there are practical ways of making sure it doesn't happen because very carefully orchestrated what the jury is going to hear. But there is a concept of possible jury nullification, that if the jury, despite the law and despite the facts, just thinks that it's not just sending this person to jail, well, then they can just find him not guilty. You probably can't tell the jurors that they have that right. But if they figure it out on their own, that is within their power to do. So you have to have a trial by jury in a criminal case. That's part of what due process means. Used to be 12 unanimous jurors. Now maybe it doesn't have to quite be unanimous, and probably you can get away with as few as about 6. If you get less than 6 jurors, then you're probably going to be running into problems. It has to be a jury of your peers. And really, of your peers, that means that no group can be systematically excluded. So if by the strangest of coincidences, even though the population of this town is, a lot of African-Americans, but just, well, lo and behold, there were no African-Americans on the jury. Well, that might be a problem because you can't systematically exclude any group of the population because it's supposed to be a jury of your peers. It's supposed to be, kind of average people off the street. How are juries selected? Well, there's the process of voir dire, V-O-I-R-D-I-R-E. And as I think I mentioned in another one, please don't say voir dire. It's voir dire. It's from French. To see what they have to say. So you ask questions of the jurors, and then each side can ask that one of the jurors be excused for some cause. So, they have to be unbiased jurors. If one of the jurors says, I'm biased, I want to convict him even though I think he's innocent. Well, you could have the person excluded for cause because they're biased. And each side, the prosecution and the defense, has a certain number of peremptory challenges. They just have a bad feeling about juror number 7 so that they can just have that person stricken. Now, under the Batson case, of course, the prosecutor if the prosecutor has a bad feeling about somebody because of the color of their skin, well, they can't exclude them for that reason. But they generally don't have to give their reasons. The jury, it has to be of your peers. It should be an impartial, unbiased jury. So it has to be in some ways insulated from publicity. You have to make sure that the jury is deciding the case based upon what they hear in court, not what they hear about it on TV or on Facebook or something. That can be hard. That can be challenging. The judge instructs the jury, don't listen to that other stuff. Just decide it based upon what's here. In extreme cases, it has to be pretty extreme before this is going to happen. There could be a change of venue. So, the people in the Twin Cities have read about this case every day for the last year. And it's just impossible for the defendant to get a fair trial here. So we'll change the venue. We'll have we'll have the trial in Rochester because there's been a lot less publicity on the stations there. Can the judge issue a gag order saying that the parties in this case are not allowed to talk about it? Well, yeah, they can. It seems to me that kind of tramples on the First Amendment just a little bit. Because if I thought I could help by trying my case in the newspapers, I probably would. But what they can't do is they can't kick out all the reporters from the uh, from the gallery because trial has to be public. You're entitled as a criminal defendant to a speedy trial. You know, they can't drag out forever. And it has to be a public trial, according to the Constitution. So, you have the right to have the press there because you have the right to a speedy and public trial. How does this trial, what happens during the trial? Well, again, it's the adversary process. It is a search for truth, but it's that search for truth is carried out in a little bit of a strange way, maybe, because it's an adversary system. You have, you know, each side has a duty to present their case in the best possible light, with the understanding that things will come out in the end. On the other hand, the prosecutor has another duty, not just to present things in the best possible light, because they have a duty to convict. That's their job. You know, their job is to put felons in jail. But they also have a duty to do justice. So if they see something unjust, they're supposed to bring it. They're not supposed to be so zealous in their duty to convict that they neglect the duty to do justice. And sometimes that, you think of, public, because in Minnesota, anyway, the county attorney is an elected official. You kind of think in terms of, well, to get reelected, they need a lot of conviction. So they're kind of biased in favor of convictions. But as Senator Klobuchar discovered, if there are accusations that you were overzealous in your duty to convict and you were not quite so worried about your duty to do justice, well, that could affect you at the polls as well. So I think it's a very good thing that we have prosecutors elected because, there's a risk that they'll be overzealous because they think convictions will be popular politically. But also we need the power to vote them out of office if they are not doing justice. That's a fair criticism, though, because they're elected officials. Well, being tough on crime, that probably plays pretty well with the voters. The defendant's duty is to the defense attorney's, their duty is to attack the state's case because the Sixth Amendment says that criminal defendants have the right to assistance of counsel. And it has to be effective assistance of counsel, even if you can't pay for it, even if you don't have any money, well, then that'll be appointed. Some attorney will be appointed to your case, a public attorney, a public defender's office, or something like that, or a private attorney who's appointed. As an attorney, you're probably asked this all the time, even if you don't practice criminal law. Well, how could you, would you represent a guilty person, or how could you defend a guilty person? Because that's my job. Because they need an attorney, the state has to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. And if my client really is guilty, well, then I think they are going to be proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Interesting, when I raised that observation with people who practice criminal law on kind of a regular basis, which I don't. They don't mind representing the guilty person because things usually work out right. In other words, their guilty client is found guilty. The cases that keep them up at night, the ones that they dread taking, are when they are representing an innocent person. Because when you're representing the innocent person, that's a pretty stressful job because you really have a lot on your hands there. I don't practice criminal law very much, but I don't mind defending that guilty person. But again, I agree with some of those longtime criminal defense attorneys that, the really difficult part of that job is representing the innocent person because just so much is riding on it. So anyway, there's a trial, and I think when we talked about civil procedure and the torts process and so forth, we said those cases have to be proved by a preponderance of the evidence. So if I'm suing you for money, I have to prove that it's more likely than not that I'm entitled to the money. So there's like a 51% chance that I'm right. That's what I have to do. But in a criminal case, the state has to prove things beyond a reasonable doubt. Whatever that means, not beyond any doubt whatsoever. But if there is a reasonable doubt, well, maybe he's not guilty because of this doubtful piece of evidence here. Well, then the person should be acquitted. But if it's maybe the person's innocent because of this this obscure theoretical issue that I happen to think of that's possible, then the person's probably guilty because that's not a reasonable doubt. Anyway, so the jury deliberates, they're found guilty, and then the judge sentences them. And usually in most states, that's solely the province of the judge. In states with the death penalty, for example, the jury will have to make a recommendation as to what the sentence will be. But in general, once the person has been found guilty, the jury's job is done, and then it falls upon the judge to decide what the punishment will be. But that's usually a pretty easy job these days. It used to be that you required the wisdom of Solomon for a judge to figure out what to sentence somebody to. Well, they don't need that wisdom anymore because they really don't have a whole lot of discretion, at least in Minnesota, because of the sentencing guidelines. Because the judge looks it up on the sentencing guidelines and they say, well, this crime is offense level number 7 and he has a criminal history score of 4. So I look at the chart and I have to sentence this person to 21 to 24 months. I'm a bleeding heart liberal judge, so I'm just gonna give him 21 months, or I'm a get tough on crime guy. I'm gonna throw the book at him, and I'm gonna give him 24 months. Well, it's really not much difference, so the judge is pretty well stuck with those guidelines, the judges don't have a lot of discretion anymore. In an extreme case, the judge could depart from those guidelines, but then either side has the right to appeal that decision. So the prosecutor can't appeal a conviction or an acquittal, but they can appeal. They say, well, no, the judge imposed the wrong sentence because, look, here's what the guidelines say. Other states, instead of using guidelines, a lot of times will use aggravating factors and mitigating factors sometimes. But judges do not have a lot of discretion when it comes to sentences these days. The death penalty is a hot button topic. We don't have the death penalty in Minnesota, although theoretically, if somebody committed a federal crime that called for the death penalty, a Minnesota defendant could be sentenced to death. And we're not going to settle the death penalty debate today. Really, there are two questions. One is it morally justified? Does the state have the right to take the life of somebody? Is there a moral justification? A separate issue, totally separate from that, is, well, does it work? Does it do any good? And those are two separate issues. So a lot of times, people arguing about it, and one saying, well, it's not morally justified. And the other person says, but it works. Well, they're two separate issues, because the person who says it's not morally justified might agree that it doesn't work. And I suppose there might be, somebody might say, well, it doesn't work. Yeah, it's not going to deter any future murders, but it's still morally justified. So those are two separate issues, and you can't get them too mixed up. One of the obvious issues that's come up a lot is, why is it that we're executing a lot more African Americans and other minorities, so is there racial bias in the system? Obviously, that's a huge issue that we're not going to settle today. Another issue that we're not going to settle today kind of boils down to, does it work? What about if we execute the occasional innocent person? You know, in my opinion, that's not really a valid argument. And people are shocked maybe when I say that, but the mere fact that you're going to execute the occasional innocent person, that shouldn't enter into our thoughts too much, because you don't want to make those mistakes. But on the other hand, you don't want to make a mistake of locking somebody up for the rest of their life. I guess there's that theoretical possibility that the mistake can be corrected if you don't execute them. But I think it's better just not to make mistakes in the first place. So even though I think I'm kind of generally opposed to the death penalty, I would say that executing the innocent people is not one of the reasons that really rings very strongly true for me. Before we finish up here in about another 10 minutes, I'm going to give you our next code number, and that's 9-397. 9-397. 9-397 is our next code number for this portion of the program before we turn to the subject of appeals on page 341 of our text. Obviously, there can be appeals just like there are in civil cases, but mostly because of the double jeopardy clause. You can't be tried twice for the same offense. So if you are tried and you are found innocent, well, the state can't appeal and say, we want to try you again. So only the defendant can appeal. The prosecution can appeal some things. So you were found guilty and the prosecutor didn't think the sentence was harsh enough. Well, they can appeal the sentence. That's not a double jeopardy issue. In general, only the defendant can appeal, but some things the state can appeal, but not after an acquittal. Because double jeopardy, you can't be tried twice for the same offense. But what is the same offense? That comes problematic in a couple of situations. One of them is that there's a different sovereign involved. So let's say that... I commit some crime that is both a state crime and a federal crime. So I decide to go rob a bank. So I go rob the bank, and robbery, of course, is a violation of Minnesota state law. The St. Paul Police Department arrests me and throws me in jail, and I'm tried in state court for robbery. I go through the list of all the attorneys who've taken my course before, and I pick out, this one's the best criminal defense attorney in the state. I'm going to hire him. Lo and behold, they get me off. I get acquitted, and I walk on this robbery charge. But that's also a federal offense. Robbing a bank that is insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation is a totally separate offense that has nothing to do with the state robbery statute. So the U.S. attorney can bring charges against me. That is not double jeopardy because it's a separate sovereign. The other issue is it double jeopardy? Was it the same behavioral incident? Is usually how it's looked upon. If I'm acquitted after this behavioral incident, so I was driving 100 miles an hour and I crashed into you and injured you, I'm on trial for injuring you, but I get acquitted for some reason. Well, they can't come back and say, well, you know what, we're acquitted on that, but we're going to charge you with speeding now. We didn't charge you with that the first time. That's a totally separate offense. We're going to charge you with speeding. They can't do that because it was part of the same behavioral incident. But if I was speeding today and I got acquitted, then they say, well, we're really going to get him. We're going to watch him. I'm speeding the next day. They can do that because it's a different behavioral incident. The other, so, but I can appeal basically raising legal issues. Just like with a civil case, I can't argue that the jury got the facts wrong, usually, unless it's pretty egregious, in which case it's kind of an error of law. The other, so I can appeal to a more limited extent, I can make a collateral attack. I can bring a federal habeas corpus petition, or as they're called more today, a 2254, after 28 U.S.C. 2254, that says state courts or federal courts can look over, under very, very limited circumstances, the actions of a state court in convicting somebody. But one of the main limitations is I have to have exhausted my state appeals. In general, any appeal that I bring to a case, I can only raise issues that I raised at trial. So I can't, if the judge makes a horrendous blunder and I say, oh, I'm just going to sit back, I'm not going to point this out to the judge because now I have an automatic appeal. Well, no, I have to object at the time. Say, judge, you made this mistake, I object. And the judge says, oh, yes, I did make a mistake, let me correct it. I can't just sit back and wait without first raising it at trial. Unless it's comes under the plain error rule. Say, well, that rule was so plain that I didn't have to object to it. Kind of the opposite of plain error is harmless error, though. So if the judge made some kind of mistake during the course of my trial, but it really wasn't a big deal. It was harmless. It didn't affect the outcome. So yeah, they got this confession out of me without reading my Miranda rights, but well, it was harmless because they had so much other evidence. So if it's a harmless error, I'm not going to do too well on appeal. So anyway, that brings us up to page 345 of our text. We finished the whole book, so I hope for the attorneys taking the program I hope I didn't tell you anything that's entirely new. You should have just about everything that we covered in this program, you should have covered in law school. Some of the cases, though, might have come out after you went to law school, so it's a good thing to be reminded of those. And more importantly, though, I think whichever chapter we covered that you practice law on a day-to-day basis, I'm sure when we covered that chapter, you were just horrified about how much I was oversimplifying things. And perhaps you might even have a few corrections. And if you do have any corrections, please email them to me. Or if you have questions, please email them to me. And I promise to answer those in the time allotted by your CLE rules. So bring those to the attention of me. But like I say, when we're covering that, I was oversimplifying that subject area. Well, I was oversimplifying all the rest of it too. But the importance of this program, I think, and I hope this worked out for you, is that if you practice property law on a day-to-day basis, you need a refresher on that criminal procedure stuff that we talked about today, because your friends are going to have questions about criminal procedure, and you need to at least get them started in the right direction. Or if you practice criminal law on a day-to-day basis and has a question about their lease, well, you need to know at least what direction to start sending them. Because after all, you're a lawyer, and you did cover all of this stuff in law school. So I think I hope you found it helpful in that regard. For anybody who might be taking the program who's not an attorney, if you were thinking about going to law school and I got you all excited about the idea of going to law school, that's great. And I wish you all the best as you embark on those studies. On the other hand, maybe you were just all excited. You were gung ho. You were going to become a lawyer. You were going to be starting law school, you listened to this program and then, wow, this is the most boring stuff you've ever heard. Then the course has also been a success in that regard too, because Law can be interesting. Law can be fun, but if it's not for you, if this stuff is boring now, it's certainly going to be boring after you're sitting in a little law office somewhere doing it on a day-to-day basis for the next 20 years. So if I've talked somebody out of becoming an attorney, I'll also consider that a success. So once again, if you do have any questions or comments, feel free to email them to me at clem.law@usa.net or give me a call, 612-378-7751. I'll be happy to answer your questions. If you're taking the course for CLE credit, please email those code numbers to me at that same address. As always, if you need more credits because you're reporting soon, I have a lot of courses available to help you out and a lot of pointers in my website, richardclem.com. So thank you very much, I look forward very much to seeing you at my future programs.